From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For more than 20 years, drummer Mickey Hart has been a member of the Grateful Dead, but his interest in drumming extends way beyond American rock and roll. On this edition of Fresh Air, Mickey Hart talks about his long exploration into the percussion traditions of the world. Also today, we talk with John Amiel about directing the new movie Tune In Tomorrow and Dennis Potter's TV series, The Singing Detective. Rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of singer Percy Mayfield. He had a string of hits in the early 50s, but his success was cut short by tragedy. And book critic John Leonard reviews Michael Crichton's latest thriller, Jurassic Park. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After meeting in Cairo with Secretary of State James Baker, China's foreign minister has indicated that his government would be willing to go along with a UN resolution authorizing the use of force against Iraq. In a session with reporters, Chen Qichen did not explicitly approve military action, but U.S. officials said at the very least Beijing will not veto the UN resolution. If passed, the resolution would approve the use of force to liberate Kuwait from the Iraqi army of occupation. China has supported all 10 of the Security Council resolutions against Iraq. Police in New York have identified the alleged assassin of Rabbi Meir Kahana as a man of Egyptian descent. The Israeli politician was shot last night in a New York City hotel. Today, more than 5,000 mourners jammed the streets in front of the Young Israel Synagogue on Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn, where a funeral service for Kahana was taking place. Andy Lancet reports.
Grief-stricken, outraged, and angry, some carried large signs in Hebrew reading Enkuma, or revenge. Inside, Rabbi Kahana's closed coffin sat at the foot of the pulpit from which he was eulogized by relatives, rabbis, and city councilman Dov Hykind.
He understood never again. He saw the gas chambers of Auschwitz. Rabbi Kahana felt the pain of the Jewish people. Not the pain of the Jewish organizations on Park Avenue or anywhere else.
Called a martyr, a leader, and teacher, Kahana's followers, some of them weeping, spoke at times of a man in contrast to his fiery, controversial image. Kahana's body will be flown this evening to Israel for burial. For National Public Radio, I'm Andy Lancet in New York.
It looks like a record turnout in the hotly contested North Carolina Senate race. Exit polls conducted by the major television networks are validating predictions of a very close finish. NPR's David Malpas reports.
The polls are still open in North Carolina for another half hour, and in Durham County, they'll remain open till 10 p.m. local time due to breakdowns of voting machines. None of the networks are projecting a winner yet, but according to the exit polls, Republican Jesse Helms is winning the white vote with 63% to 37% of whites voting for Democrat Harvey Gantt. Gantt, who is black, is projected to receive 96% of the black vote. Gantt is also the favorite of women voters today. According to the exit polls, his strong abortion rights stand seems to have given him the edge with women. I'm David Malpas in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Prices on Wall Street slid today on what traders said were uncertainties over the elections and the prospects for war in the Middle East. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 17 points to close at 2,485.15. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A standard part of any Grateful Dead concert is called drums. Everyone in the band leaves the stage, except the two drummers, Bill Kreutzmann and Mickey Hart, who play a free-form improvisation on an array of drums and percussion instruments gathered from around the world. The percussion sounds from remote regions were brought into the band by Mickey Hart, who has been collecting instruments and recording drummers from around the world for the past 19 years. Though the Grateful Dead seem to be constantly on tour, Hart has found time to study the historical and spiritual traditions of his instrument. He's written a new book called Drumming at the Edge of Magic, A Journey into the Spirit of Percussion. He's also been producing a series of recordings for Rykodisc called The World. The newest record in the World series features the music of Mickey Hart himself. It's called At the Edge, and it also features some of the percussionists he's recorded for his series, such as Olatunji from Nigeria, Zakir Hussein of India, and the Brazilian-born Ayerto. Fellow Grateful Dead member Jerry Garcia makes an appearance, along with Hart's sons Taro and Creek. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke with Hart. They begin with music from his new recording.
Father and your mother, I think, were actually champion rudimental drummers.
True.
So did you? And but he wasn't around. He left before you were born.
Yeah, he left when I was, when I was just a baby.
So did you hear stories about him when you were?
Well, yeah,
up?
He was a world champion rudimental drummer. He had won in 1939 with my mother, and so he was like a drum god. You know, when I go to competitions, I'd hear his name and listen to the stories. He was a legend, so it was sort of it was growing up in his shadow, but he was never around. So I would just, you know, I made my own way through the drum corps competitions.
Did hearing those stories about him make you want to be a drummer?
Oh, of course. You know, you wanted to idolize your dad. You know, you wanted to be like your father. And I really didn't have much choice. He left me a drum pad and a couple of sticks. That's all we really had, you know. And then he just disappeared for 18 years. So all I had was the pad, and that was my father. And so I would practice the pad all the time. You know, I would just sit in the corner, actually in the closet, and use the closet as a resonator and make it louder. And I would just sit there, and I would practice the rudiments. My mom would show me rudiments every week, and eventually it all sort of came together for me.
Did you somehow have this feeling that drumming would, that if you drummed someday, would lead you to your father?
No, I never really thought that when I was really little, until I was about 17 or 18 when I found a picture of him in a brochure, and I tracked him down in California, and we united for a few years before he died. But no, it was mostly just an urge and a compulsion and something that was just drawing me into its, sucking me into its web, you know, it was pulling me.
The drumming.
The drums, yeah. The power of the drums just sucked me up. Yeah, I had no choice. I was just following my muse, you know. That was the way it was.
Can you tell us about these drumsticks he left you?
Oh, these were, they were called snakewood sticks. They were South American wood, and they had little silver ends to them, butts. And they were weighted really heavily, and they were just magic sticks. They were very heavy and very well balanced, and he won them in the championships, and I used them in my competition. They were just artifacts from another age, you know. You don't build sticks like that anymore. You know, thousands of dollars worth of sticks, and a pair of sticks. Really finely honed instruments.
So when did you start taking drumming really seriously and begin to really see yourself as a drummer and know that this was something you were going to do for a long time?
About 3 or 4 years old, I imagine. When I hit the pad, I knew from the first time I hit the pad, it was that rush of, that first rush of noise. I knew that I loved the drum, I loved the sound, and I like hitting things, and I like the report.
So when you were a little kid, you would be home by yourself a lot, pounding away?
Oh, of course. That's the way you learn an instrument, you know, many hours of just solitude, you know, and finding the voice of the drum and finding your voice. And finding how they both go together, finding the sweet spot, you know, and that's what you look for. A musician always looks for the sweet spot, the place where it sounds just really juicy and good and the right place to be at that time. That's what a musician looks for.
How old were you when you got your first drum? So far, you just had this little practice
I was about 11 years old, you know, before I got a real drum set. And then I started learning how to play the set, which was different than the single drum. And then I started to dance on the drums. And that led into rock and roll and jazz, big band, and so forth, and Grateful Dead.
You quit high school and joined the Air Force. Why did you do that?
Well, I had gone through high school, and there was no place left to go. I mean, we had won all the championships, and I wanted to be a man drummer. You know, I had it with being a kid drummer. I was in the all-state bands, and there was no place to go. And the Air Force had the best drum and bugle corps in the world, in Washington, D.C., the Blue Eagles. So I thought by joining the Air Force, it would just pop me up into the big leagues, and I would be up there with the big guys, the national champions, the seniors. And it was a place to go for a teacher, I thought, or just actually field experience every day, playing the drum, marching the troops, playing at night, and so forth and so on. So, and it was part of my rite of passage, just becoming a man. You know, this is what happens. You know, you leave the street, and you join the Air Force, you drum, you grow up.
So was it a good place for you to work
on your
drumming?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. I mean, I had 4 years of, it was a blissful 4 years for me. I learned a lot. I learned to drum hard, and also I learned martial arts. That's what I did in the service.
You kind of mentioned this earlier, but just before you went overseas, when you were in the Air Force, you actually got together with your father. And could you tell us a little more about what that meeting was like?
Well, when I first found him, I found out he was in the Savings and Loan Institute in San Bernardino.
How did you find? Were you trying to track him down?
No, I found a brochure when I was in basic training. I found a brochure in his in the band room, and I contacted the gentleman whose picture he had put. I mean, when I contacted the fellow who wrote the or published the brochure, Remo Belli, in North Hollywood, and he told me my father was in a savings and loan.
Now, the brochure had your father on it, or is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it was him holding a stick saying, "I've tried these drum heads, these Weather King drum heads, and they're the best in the world." He used to practice on these heads and sort of dent them when he was when they were learning how to make plastic drum heads. This Remo developed the heads, so my dad used to test it for him. And they were friends. I didn't know this. I went to see him, and then he led me to my father, and I walked in on him and told him who I was, and we drummed all day, and we became friends.
What do you mean you drummed all day?
I gave him a pair of sticks. I had a pair of sticks, and we just sat there and played the standard classics.
Did you have drums there, or would you be
no,
on
just
the
on
desk?
The desk. You only need is a pair of drumsticks. You can drum on anything.
Do you carry drumsticks with you everywhere?
Everywhere, yeah. Of course. If they're not near me, I know that I'm losing my instrument. You know, if I can't reach around in my bag or in my car or wherever I am and feel a pair of drumsticks, I feel uneasy. You know, I mean, that means that you're losing your instrument. It's too far away from you. You have to have it with you all the time just to remind you, you know, what you're doing.
My guest is Mickey Hart, and he's one of the drummers of the Grateful Dead. And he's just written a book called Drumming at the Edge of Magic. So how did you end up joining the Grateful Dead? I mean, you came back from the Air Force. You were in New York, and the Grateful Dead was
well,
a
I
band.
Came out to the West Coast after leaving the Air Force and started a music store with my dad called Drum City, Heart Music, in San Francisco. And then I met Billy. I was hanging out with Count Basie's drummer, Sonny Payne, and Basie was playing the Fillmore. And I was down there, and someone introduced me and Billy, who was the drummer for the newly formed Grateful Dead. And we hit it off really well. And I started teaching him some of the drum rudiments. And he invited me to play with the band one night. And that was it. You know, after it was all over, everybody looked around and realized this was the Grateful Dead. And that's where it all started.
In your book, you tell this story of how that night you met Bill Kreutzmann, and you guys were out in the parking lot talking, and that you were drumming on the cars.
Oh, yeah. We had a time. We had a few beers, and then we went around the city until 6 o'clock in the morning and playing on everything. The city became our instrument. It was the night. It was male bonding, you know. Drums is the way drummers bond. And then we played on cars and on, you know, on everything, you know, tin cans and anything we could. We just had a blast that night, and we knew that we were brothers of the drum right then and there. We just shared that same groove, and we've been friends ever since, 25 years now.
So the very first time that you played with the Grateful Dead, can you tell us about that? Like, how was drumming with the Dead different from what you'd been doing? And
Well, the Grateful Dead had a certain kind of breath to it. It would breathe like an animal. You know, it was live. It was organic, and it wasn't metric in the sense that it was one beat followed the next exactly like the beat before it. It took on its own personality, and it was thousands of people, you know, obviously ingesting strange substances, playing this living music, and I couldn't believe it. It was really loud and way out of hand. And I said, Jesus, this is wonderful. This is for me. And I just jumped in and tried to hang on, you know, and then all of a sudden this force field took you away and it sucked you up in its jet stream. And then the next thing, you know, it was 6 hours later and everybody was standing there looking at each other. When the smoke cleared, we were all smiling. You know, it was unbelievable. You know, what just had gone down. It was magic. You know, we were all taken away on this little magic carpet ride, and the groove was strong enough that it would eat the audience. It was literally eating the audience. It was very big. So we decided that this would be something that we could do for the rest of our lives. You know, once you see something that strong and that powerful, you just can't put it back in the closet.
You were a master of the rudimental drumming technique, and so did you find that helped you because it gave you a good foundation, or was it really kind of a hindrance that you had to get rid of?
Well, it was both. It was I had to lose the martial feeling and get into the rock and roll and swing jazz feeling, but it also gave me precision. It also gave me focus and power and incredible amounts of endurance. I had to march the troops 5 miles every day back and forth in the Air Force, so I had a lot of power. So it had its pros and cons. I, you know, there are good things about it and bad things about it, but what happened was it mutated. The style mutated into the present style, which is a bit of both worlds, of all the worlds, as it should be. You know, it's a piece of me, what I've been through and my collective experience over the years. It's not anybody else's. It's my personal signature. I don't try to be like anybody else. I never could. It wasn't for me. It would be like Buddy Rich or Gene Krupa, yet they were my idols. And I hoped that I'd be an original sound, and that's what I tried to do.
So in the Grateful Dead, you have two drummers, you mm-hmm. and Bill Kreutzmann, yeah, right. which is still kind of unusual. Most bands don't have two mm-hmm. drummers. Can you tell us something about the interplay between the two of you? Well, do you each play really differently?
There's an incredible kind of nuance that we can both form together. We try to make it like one big drum section. There's power, obviously, two people playing a unison part or semi-unison can get. And then there's the rhythmic possibilities we can achieve by splitting up the rhythm. He can take the six, I can take the four, or what have you. And the rhythmic possibilities are enormous. They're unlimited. It allows the guitarist and the keyboard a springboard, a place to take a rhythm and go off with it on any kind of a rhythmic level. So there's power and there's also nuance that's available within the intricacies governing the pulse. Billy and I are sort of tied at the heart, so we beat as one big organism. It's... Sometimes it's an overwhelming rush of rhythm and noise.
Okay, I want to play just a little something from an old Dead album. And this is Alligator, which, mm-hmm. according to you, is the first song that you ever played with the Dead professionally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's got this really big instrumental jam in the middle. And so we're going to listen to just a little bit of that now.
Okay.
Then I ain't coming back around.
That's the Grateful Dead doing Alligator. My guest is Mickey Hart. He's one of the drummers of the Grateful Dead. And for the past 20 years, he's also been recording some of the traditional music of Asia, Africa, and Eastern Europe. He's now producing those recordings into a series called The World, which is being released on Ryko Disc. And as part of that series, Hart has done a new recording of his own music called At the Edge. And he's written a new book about drumming at the edge of magic, a journey into the spirit of percussion. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is drummer Mickey Hart. You called your CD At the Edge.
Yeah.
It's a phrase that you use a lot in your book. What does that mean to you?
Well, there's the edge to everything. You know, it's the place between consciousness and unconsciousness or subconsciousness or whatever. It's not necessarily the music that you can chew gum to or walk around without participating in. It appeals to the spirit side. It doesn't appeal to the... It's not the easy listening music. So I'm after something different. And these songs or soundscapes came from my time exploring on the edge, you know, doing the research for the book, which involved finding out the power of these ancient instruments. These are my dream songs. These are the things I brought back from that time at the edge.
One of the drums that you write about is the tar, and that's an Egyptian drum, and you got one from Hamza El-Din, who's a musician from Egypt. He gave you one of these. And you write in the book that you collect them and that you used to take one with you everywhere because having one close at hand steadied you. So what is it about the tar that has that effect?
Well, the tar is the only real romance drum that I know. It's quiet. You play it with your fingertips, and it's an instrument of the desert. And it calms me. It's a meditative kind of a thing. I sit there and I meditate when I play it, and it's very soft, and it's romance, because you play the high overtones of it. You don't beat it. You gently tap it, and you just coax the sound out. So it's a sort of magical drum that it appeals to the quiet inside. It's more ecstatic than it is trance-like. You know, where there's trance, you need loud music. In the ecstatic, quiet moments, you use a quiet drum that appeals to a whole other side of you.
Well, let's listen to the tar, and this is off of a record which you produced called Egypt. You made the recordings over there, and it features Hamza El-Din and the tar. Write about certain drums as being very powerful. What's the most powerful drum, and what is it about it that makes it more powerful than some
Well, some
other
of the drums from the Tibetan drums, the
Damarus,
which are made from the skulls of humans and consecrated, they're powerful drums. I mean, they're medicine drums. Any drum that's used for religious rites has some power to it. That means that it affects you in a way that allows you to transcend, to become conscious. That's what drumming is all about, especially the religious parts of it. Some drums allow you to move in and out of the trance states and allow you to allow for possession, for what have you. It seems like the power of the sound of the drum and the redundancy of the beat are the things that trigger you into the other states of awareness. So the drum has been used throughout history, shamanic performance. It took me back to the mother goddess cultures when I found out that the mother goddess and the drum, there was a direct relation between the mother goddess and the drum. Now, this is 40,000 years ago. And the mother goddess religions, which lasted until about 500 AD, were all trance-driven possession cults. All these women, you know, and men, of course, were using the drum and the trance to drive that the mother goddess society. That's the center of the religion. When I found out this, I mean, I was just aghast, because here we have our earliest incarnation of rhythm and rapture.
Do you ever feel that you've been at a disadvantage being an American, that you've missed out on something really important because you were born into this modern culture? And do you sometimes wish that maybe you'd come from Africa or India and that you could have followed just this one uncluttered path?
Yes, all the time. You know, I mean, until I... Yeah, I always suspected that we were bankrupt and we weren't really given our musical legacy. And then when I went into the library for the first time and looked and popped up percussion and wanted to see all the books about it, and there weren't any there, I realized there was a giant gap in the scholarly record. And that's what first put me on to writing this book. I was wondering why there's a million books on violins and pianos and nothing on percussion. Well, there were things written on percussion, but they were in little tiny isolated little pockets all out there in the archives, and they were mostly not in English, and they were written by scholars that didn't think it was important enough to translate it back into English. So that's what started me on the road to find out where this heritage was. I mean, the Africans are born with it, you know, they know everything about it. Almost every other culture has their history, but not here, not in the West. And I wondered why. So this was the book, was the quest to unlock those secrets, you know, to find out what was the power of this drum? Where did it come from? How? Why? And why are we still, you know, we still pounding skin to get this kind of a feeling? And this is what these things, this is what the research unlocked for me.
Great. Mickey Hart, thanks a lot for
coming. My pleasure. Thank you.
Mickey Hart spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. His new book is Drumming at the Edge of Magic. Hart's new CD on Rykodisc is called At the Edge. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's more from Mickey Hart's new CD.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Amiel directed the TV series The Singing Detective about the fevered imagination of a writer hospitalized with a ghastly skin disease. Now Amiel has directed the new movie Tune In Tomorrow about a young writer who falls in love with his older aunt only to find their romance has been turned into a soap opera. Coming up, a talk with the British director. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles singer Percy Mayfield. Back in the early 50s, Mayfield was one of the sophisticated black singers who were called the Sepia Sinatras. And the author of The Andromeda Strain and The Terminal Man is back with a new thriller. We have a review of Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The polls are now closed in Kentucky, and NPR is projecting Republican Mitch McConnell is the winner in the Senate race there. In New Hampshire, Republican Bob Smith is the projected winner in the Senate race there. The governor's race in California is expected to be a close one. NPR's Ina Jaffe has more in the contest between Democrat Dianne Feinstein, the former mayor of San Francisco, and U.S. Senator Pete Wilson, the Republican candidate.
On the major issues, there are few differences between the candidates. Both support abortion rights and the death penalty. Both oppose offshore oil drilling. Feinstein has presented herself as tough but caring. Wilson portrays himself as the compassionate conservative. The campaigns have been largely negative. Feinstein has criticized Wilson for his poor attendance record in the Senate and for upholding President Bush's veto of the civil rights bill. Wilson claims Feinstein raised taxes and left San Francisco in debt. At stake in this election is the political map of California for the next decade. The heavily Democratic legislature will draw new districts for state and federal lawmakers. Wilson has promised that if he's elected governor, he will veto any plan weighted in favor of the Democrats. In Los Angeles, I'm Ina Jaffe.
With a projected victory of former Senator Lawton Chiles in Florida, NPR is projecting that Democrats will hold 30 governorships and the Republicans 18 by the end of the evening, for a total gain of one state for the Democrats. NPR is projecting that the Senate ratio of Democrats to Republicans will stay the same after today's elections, 55 Democrats to 45 Republicans. Election officials in Illinois are predicting voter turnout of around 59%. Incumbent Democratic Senator Paul Simon says a smaller turnout could hurt his reelection bid. Mary Carlin reports from Springfield.
Paul Simon says his supporters could not sit at home and get him elected. He's hoping Democratic voters get out in record numbers because he says elections can be lost by apathetic voters or those who think Simon has it made over his challenger, Congresswoman Lynn Martin.
With those kind of numbers, maybe people are going to stay home. And when polling becomes really unpredictable is if you have a light vote.
Both Simon and Martin say something must be done about the level of negative campaigning. They say the current process seems to be turning off voters. On election eve, Martin called Simon a thoughtful man and said he's an excellent representative of his party's liberal traditions. Martin also urged voters to go to the polls today, no matter what party they support. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Carlin in Springfield, Illinois.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 17 points to close at 2,485.15 on volume of some 141 million shares. Trading today was only moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. After World War II, several black singers emerged who became known as the Sepia Sinatras. They included Nat King Cole, Charles Brown, and one man who's all but forgotten now. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers Percy Mayfield.
I was born way down in Louisiana. I love the weird sound, 'cause that's my home, way down in Louisiana. I'm going back and try to settle down, gonna settle down, gonna settle down, gonna settle down in my own hometown.
Percy Mayfield was, in fact, born in Louisiana, in a town called Minden, which was so small that it gives a twist to the usual learn to sing in church item in his biography. Mayfield was a Methodist, and thus his church didn't have a choir, so he'd go up the road to the Baptist to indulge his love of singing. Showbiz was in his blood, His father was a dancer and his mother was a singer, so it's no surprise to learn that Percy took off onto the road as a singer as soon as he could. He spent his late teens in Houston, then moved to the West Coast. Since almost nothing is known about this period in his life, we can only guess where he picked up his musical sophistication. In fact, what little I've been able to learn about him starts when he was 30 years old, in 1950. Sometime early in that year, he sent a song to Art Roop of Specialty Records in Los Angeles, a song like nobody had ever before recorded, with a sinuous melody and lyrics that transcended its rather mundane title, Please Send Me Someone to Love.
Heaven, please send to all mankind understanding and peace in mind. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love, someone to love. Show the world how to get along. Peace will enter when the hate is gone. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Please send me someone to love.
Now here was a guy who had his priorities straight. Who could resist it? The answer was nobody. Please Send Me Someone to Love flew onto the Harlem Hit Parade, as the chart was called, and lived there, mostly at the top, for a phenomenal 27 weeks. The diminutive songwriter and singer found himself the hottest property in Los Angeles all of a sudden, with women responding to his message in droves. The record was so big that its flip even went into the top 10, a song with a darker side, which, as it would turn out, was much more typical of Percy Mayfield's songwriting.
Learn to love me or leave me, either one you want to do. Learn to love me or leave me, either one you want to do. Because strange things is happening, baby, and something may happen to you.
Mayfield's next record, Lost Love, went to number 2 while Please Send Me Someone to Love was still number 1. And again, it was a two-sided hit with a chilling flip side.
I'm laying here wondering which way to go. My baby's left me like she did before. It's so confusing, 'cause I'm all alone. I can't live without my baby, but still my baby's gone.
That was called Life is Suicide, a strange thought if there ever was one. In 1952, Mayfield really went over the top with this stuff on a song that would one day be one of his best-known ones, The River's Invitation.
I spoke to the river, and the river spoke back to me. And it said, you look so lonely, you look full of misery. And if you can't find your baby, come and make your home with me.
Of course, there's a trick ending to this one. He finds his baby, and they settle down in a little house by the river. Still, it wasn't until he recut the song for Ray Charles' Tangerine Records in 1963 that people would buy it. In 1952, during what would probably have been a temporary slump in his career, Percy Mayfield was in an automobile accident that scarred his face. He thought that he was maimed, that his beautiful face was ruined, and became reclusive, living the depressing lyrics of some of his songs and drinking heavily. Even though he did record from time to time, it was a long while before he'd start performing publicly again. Fortunately, he had money from songwriting coming in, especially after 1961, when Ray Charles discovered this demo recording.
Now, this one is the duet, you know, Hit the Road, Jack. It's a story where a woman getting rid of a man. She got some kitties in her corner.
Hit the road, Jack, and don't come back no more.
No more, no more, no more.
Hit the road, Jack, and don't come back no more.
Now, what'd you say?
Hit the road, Jack, and don't come back no more.
No more, no more, no more.
Hit the road, Jack. Don't come back no more.
Oh, woman, oh, woman, you sure is mean. You the meanest old woman that I ever seen. But I guess if you say so, bop, bop, I better pack my things and go. That's right.
Specialty Records has recently re-released most of the Percy Mayfield recordings they had in their vaults. But Mayfield had died in 1984, bitter at the hand he'd been dealt. He had a point. When I was researching this piece, one of the few mentions I found of him in my reference books claimed he was Curtis Mayfield's father and said almost nothing else. He wasn't, of course, but his being a father of modern rhythm and blues is good enough for me.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
No more, no more.
Hit the road, Jack, and don't come back no more. Don't come back no more. Don't come back no more.
This is Fresh Air. A soap opera borrows from real life, and real life becomes as hyperbolic as a soap opera in the new movie Tune In Tomorrow. It's set at a New Orleans radio station in 1951, where a famed scriptwriter, played by Peter Falk, has just been hired to write a new soap opera. Keanu Reeves plays a 21-year-old news writer at the station who has fallen in love with his 35-year-old Aunt Julia, played by Barbara Hershey. Their forbidden romance gets worked into the scriptwriter's stories, and the real lovers get more carried away by their passions, listening to the wild behavior of their fictional counterparts. Tune In Tomorrow was directed by my guest John Amiel. He got his start at the BBC, where he directed the series The Singing Detective, about the fevered visions of a writer who was hospitalized with a hideous skin disease. It was a big hit on American public television. Amiel also directed the movie Queen of Hearts. In this scene from Tune In Tomorrow, Peter Falk prepares his cast of tired actors to tackle his new script.
I want your souls to enter those microphones and emerge like ghosts in the homes of our listeners. There's an army of them out there, groping blindly, toiling in the darkness, waiting. For what? For you! For your incandescent, brilliant, palpitating talent to light up their miserable, impoverished, dull, and worthless lives!
Tune In Tomorrow was adapted from Mario Vargas Llosa's novel Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter. I asked Emil if Vargas Llosa was involved with the film.
No. Mario was too busy losing an election in Peru. He's very good-natured about it as well, which is why I can make that joke at his expense. But he was, and therefore left us completely to ourselves, which I think was really helpful. He saw the film for the first time, and indeed I met him for the first time when it was shown at the Deauville Film Festival. And I was nervous as a kitten about how he'd respond. I was terribly keen that he should like it, and yet we'd taken enormous liberties with this novel. And to my great delight, he loved it.
I want to read a line from the novel Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter and ask you about interpreting this into the movie. And this is something said by the character who's played by Keanu Reeves in the movie, and he's a young man who falls in love with his older aunt, and he works at a radio station. And he says, I greatly enjoyed spying on the cast when they were in front of the microphone, hungry, shabbily dressed actors and actresses on the decline, whose tender, crystal-clear young voices were terribly different from their old-looking faces, their bitter mouths, and their tired eyes. Can you talk about how you translated that into the movie?
Yes, it was great fun to do. I mean, one of the joyful things about radio drama is that, of course, the actors can be completely different in appearance from the characters they portray. And so what we did was we had, for example, Richard B. Schull, who, God bless him, is no oil painting and 55, playing the young, handsome, virile, romantic hero. And then you cut and see what the audience imagines. And that's Peter Gallagher looking handsome and dashing speaking with the same voice.
So really what you've done is you've created three casts for the movie. Barbara Hershey and Keanu Reeves play the real-life lovers. And then there's the cast of the over-the-hill-looking actors performing the soap opera. And then in the movie within the movie, you have the idealized visual enactments of the radio soap opera, and these like handsome and beautiful actors and actresses are playing out what the radio audience is imagining in their minds.
It sounds very complicated. In fact, when you see it on the screen, it makes its own kind of sense. And I love that idea that actually when people listen to the radio, they see something that's often more magical and wonderful and idealized than anything that you could have dreamed up to show them on the screen.
Now, I read in the newspaper that your producer wanted the title of the movie changed from Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter to something else, and Tune In Tomorrow was arrived at. Did you care that the title was changed? The idea was to make it more commercially marketable and to have a title that would telegraph what the movie was about better than Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter.
Yes, there were a number of things. It was a very hard choice to make because it is, after all, a great work of literature to those who know it. But basically, the film is very, very different from the novel. It's very faithful to the spirit of it, but exceptionally unfaithful to the letter of the novel. So first off, we didn't want people going along to see what they thought was going to be a faithful rendition of a Peruvian novel and saying, hey, guys, this is false advertising here. This isn't the novel at all. And secondly, we discovered that to most people who hadn't heard of the novel, Aunt Julia and the scriptwriter just conjured up images of old ladies and some sort of shadowy literary figure. And given that this is always an original film that was going to be hard to categorize, we felt we were setting out with too much of a disadvantage there.
I think a lot of American television viewers know your work through The Singing Detective, the series based on Dennis Potter's script. Well, the series written by Dennis Potter that you directed. And there's a connection, I think, between The Singing Detective and Tune In Tomorrow, and that is that both are about how real life compares with the imaginary life you live through either songs, in the case of The Singing Detective, or soap operas, in the case of Tune In Tomorrow. I'm interested in hearing about what level you relate to this kind of fantasy life on.
I find that there are many, many moments in my life where what goes on in my head does seem more real than what goes on outside it. And I think it's true for everybody, actually. I don't think it's just something peculiar to myself or to Dennis Potter, who wrote Singing Detective. I think we all have those moments, and I think it's fascinating to see them actually realized on the screen. When Danny Kaye made Walter Mitty, I think everybody identified at one point or another with those fantasies. I'm just exploring different aspects of those same ideas, really.
For our listeners who haven't seen The Singing Detective, would you describe the basic storyline, the basic concept?
Okay, here is 7 hours, the most complex television, in a three-line poem. I would say The Singing Detective was essentially a psychological case history set in the form of a detective story and put to music. It's about a man very sick with a dreadful skin disease working his way painfully through towards a cure by sifting through his memories and recreating in his mind an old detective story that he wrote many, many years before. It's a most extraordinary concept, completely Dennis's own, and probably one of the most original ideas, I think, that anybody has ever had on television.
How closely did you work with the writer Dennis Potter on The Singing Detective?
He said that we worked together as brothers. It was very like that. He was never on the set. He couldn't bear to be on the set, because a writer on a film set is always a rather sad creature. They're curiously superfluous. But he and I worked incredibly closely on the scripts. So it took me completely by surprise when Dennis called me up and said 2 months before we were due to start shooting this thing, well, you'll be very pleased to hear I'm going to rewrite the whole thing, which threw me into a complete state of panic. But that's exactly what he did, this extraordinary man. He sat down and rewrote the whole 7 hours while he was under attack by this awful disease.
Well, yeah, so, the main character in The Singing Detective has a terrible skin disease that leaves him, mm-hmm. like, too sick and too unsightly to leave the hospital.
That's right.
And Dennis Potter has a very similar condition. Did he not come to the set in part because of his skin problem? I know that there's times when he rarely leaves the house when his skin erupts.
That's right. Well, he rewrote, as I said, the entire 7 hours while he was under attack from that same disease. And I'm here to tell you, some people might have thought that we were exaggerating in the film, but there was a period in his life when Dennis looked even worse than our man on the screen did.
So do you think that he rewrote the script in a hallucinatory, fevered state?
Well, he rewrote it. I think you have to be in a hallucinatory, fevered state to rewrite 7 hours of material of that kind of complexity in a period of about 6 weeks. And he rewrote it with a skill and judgment that I really have never come across in any writer before. He seemed to have an absolutely unerring instinct for keeping everything that was good and chucking out everything that was not so good.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
John Amiel's new film is Tune In Tomorrow. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what stories do you have from the Persian Gulf?
Well, we have a story today by NPR's Ted Clark about the process of demonizing Saddam Hussein and Iraq. It seems to be an effort by the U.S. government, and perhaps it is to prepare the American public for military action against Iraq. Also, a story by Maria Hinojosa in New York City about gangs there, particularly the gang FTS, one of whose members was held responsible for the shooting of a Utah tourist in New York City a couple of months ago. And it's, of course, Election Day, and we will have, as soon as they come in, results from congressional and gubernatorial races around the country.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Michael Crichton has written several suspense novels about science and medical technology out of control. His books include The Andromeda Strain and The Terminal Man. He also directed and wrote the screenplay for the movie Coma. His new novel, Jurassic Park, is about a genetic engineering experiment that accidentally produces monsters. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
It's hard to imagine a novel full of more hardware and mysticism than Crichton's last one, Sphere, in which a feminist zoologist, a gee-whiz physicist, an overweight psychologist, and a black mathematician went 1,000 feet below the sea to look into a sunken starship and talk with computers to an alien life form, a huge ball bearing full of fireflies. After so much hardware, this ball bearing proved to be a kind of Jungian cave where human beings discovered their dark side, their predatory shadow. And there you've got as much mysticism as you need, maybe more. In his new novel, Jurassic Park, Crichton has added a D to this H and M. The D is for dinosaur. Hardware plus mysticism plus dinosaurs seems to me a recipe for a boy's book that will sell forever, and I love it. There are scientists, male and female, trapped on a jungle island off the coast of Costa Rica, where they've been summoned by a crackpot billionaire because something's wrong with his brand new theme park. What's wrong is that the dinosaurs are acting up. What the billionaire has done with his hired biotechnologists, recombinant DNA biologists, and fossil-coddling paleontologists is to breed a whole new batch of dinosaurs, big and little, flying and swimming, vegetarian and carnivorous. They've done this by collecting enough DNA from insects, preserved over eons in amber, the fossilized resin of prehistoric tree sap. These insects used to bite the big beasts and suck up some dinosaur blood. The rest is computer analysis, phylogenetic mapping, routine metabolic enzyme engineering, fertilized eggs, irradiation, and look out. All these beasts are supposed to be female, but they aren't. They're supposed to stay on the island, but they haven't. They're supposed to be monitored by motor sensors, but they know how to hide. And when they're hungry or annoyed, well, I'm only giving you a little bit of the hardware. Crichton's passionate about computers and furious about genetic engineering. I'll give you even less about the mysticism, because it boils down to chaos theory, the most mystical and most fashionable of the new speculative mathematics, and it involves fractals, which belong to a non-Euclidean sort of geometry, and I haven't got all day. But according to chaos theory, everything's random, which for scientists is almost the same thing as Murphy's Law. What can go wrong will go wrong, and so it does, and there's nothing anybody can do about it but run away as fast as they can, including the little boy who is necessary to any story about dinosaurs. Lots of people on Michael Crichton's Black Magic Island won't run fast enough. What we have in Jurassic Park, of course, is a cautionary tale about big science and big business and big greed and Faust and Mephistopheles. But we've also got terrific H&M. And this Sunday, if I go to the Natural History Museum, I'll bring my bow and arrow.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa Bocchini. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Gordon Parks about being out on his own at age 15, broke and lonely, and going on to become one of Life magazine's celebrated photojournalists and to direct the films The Learning Tree, Shaft, and Leadbelly. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.